You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com, episode number 30, Christmas and Freedom. And I've had too much caffeine.
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
I want to live again, and I want to look them straight in the eye, and I want to tell them what a cheap, lying, no-good, rotten, four-flushing, low-life, snake-licking, dirt-eating, inbred, overstuffed, ignorant, blood-sucking, dog-kissing, brainless...
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercial. Makeup, even in Brooklyn it's the same.
That thing had nine lives, she just spent them all.
Woo! I triple dog dare you!
I don't believe you're an angel. I think you're a demon right out of...
Don't say that.
Does someone need a hug?
Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
Sentimental hogwash.
What was the last thing you and Charlie did before you went to bed Christmas Eve?
We shared a bowl of sugar, some shots of brown liquor, played my shotguns, field-dressed a cat, looked for women.
The worst toy maker in the world. A cotton-headed ninny muggins.
My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouth's bleeding! Doo-doo pedals! Doo-doo! There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas and welcome to this, the 30th episode of the Merry Podcast at MyMerryChristmas.com. My name is Jeff Westover, founder of My Merry Christmas, where we are celebrating 22 years of being the internet's longest ongoing celebration of Christmas and the world's largest Christmas community. The Merry Podcast is a joint production of Merry Christmas Radio and Kringle Radio, our two year-round radio stations dedicated to all things Christmas. You can find Merry Christmas Radio on Live 365 and Kringle Radio at kringleradio.com year-round. This time around on the Merry Podcast, we take a longer look at Christmas at War, specifically Christmas during World Wars 1 and 2. We have covered in past episodes Christmas during the Revolutionary War and Christmas during the Civil War. Now we cover the two great wars of the 20th century with a look at how Christmas was celebrated and observed on all sides of the conflict. And speaking of war, we'll get once again into the war on Christmas, but we'll do it by talking about the differences between religious freedom and freedom of religion. They are two different things, and they are center stage in the annual event we'll soon see erupt in the media called the War on Christmas, as we do every year. Also in this episode, we take a look at alternative Christmas music, and when we say alternative, we mean some out there stuff. You see, feedback we've received from the past several episodes indicates that we've been leaning a little heavy on the side of country Christmas music. I find that kind of funny, because my personal taste in music just doesn't go that way. I think our music selection has been more due to the chosen themes of the podcast rather than something that I prefer. But I see the point, so this time around, we'll make it a topic to explore some of the alternative stuff of Christmas that is out there, and there is a lot of it. We begin, however, on a sweet note with Darius Rucker, lead vocalist of Hootie and the Blowfish, giving us Candy Cane Christmas from 2009.
Ha!
tiny little boots covered in snow. Apple cider warming on the stove. Tinsel twinkling everywhere. Holly hanging on the stairs. It must be Christmas Eve. Angel sitting high upon a tree, watching over presents patiently. Milk and cookies on a plate. Santa Claus is on his way. The kids should be fast asleep, but sleigh bells are ringing in their heads, twisting like little tops in their beds. Trying to sleep, but it's no use, with hoofs tap tapping on the roof. Peeking out the window to see what they can see. It's a candy cane Christmas, sweet as it can be. The kids will wake up awfully early, 'cause they can't wait to see if Santa made it, so they can say, look what he brought me. Sleigh bells are ringing in their heads, twisting like little tops in their beds. Trying to sleep, but it's no use, with hoofs tap tapping on the roof. Peeking out the window to see what they can see. It's a candy cane Christmas, sweet as it can be. It's a candy cane Christmas, sweet as it can be.
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
In our past discussions of Christmas in the 1940s, we have talked about what a dynamic decade it was and how Christmas then shapes Christmas now. Beloved songs such as White Christmas and I'll Be Home for Christmas came from that era, and so many elements of modern Christmas celebration were defined by what it was like for those who celebrated Christmas at war. But for many folks, the war didn't end in 1945, for Europe especially, where Christmas traditions took root for centuries. The war took Christmas away in 1945, 46, 47, and 48, well after the war. These were lean, difficult years, especially for anyone living in Eastern Europe. For military personnel, many of them Americans who grew up during the Great Depression, what they witnessed during these years would impact them for the rest of their lives. Millions were homeless, without work and without money or means. Homes were destroyed, government structure demolished, and organizational relief was pretty limited. The first in were churches and relief organizations. The military was transformed from fighting units to rescue crews, rebuilding and resupplying the destroyed peoples of Poland, France, Belgium, Germany, and others. Political realities were particularly harsh. While the Soviet Union was an allied member, they didn't see eye to eye with just about anyone over what to do with conquered Germany. Not wanting the rise of another dictator to again threaten their western borders, the Russians wanted and received Eastern Germany to occupy, and they locked it down tight. In the middle of that zone was the capital city of Berlin, divided most famously by the Russians, who eventually erected a high wall to separate the east from the west. To help those in West Berlin, the remaining Allies established a flight pattern that would allow them to land planes in West Berlin around the clock by flying planes in from the north and then from the south. The Berlin airlift was part of the Marshall Plan, the American effort to recover Europe, to reestablish peace, tranquility, and democracy to Europe. And it was the setting for this great tale of American generosity and Christmas spirit. Colonel Gale S. Halverson of Provo, Utah, piloted a C-54 aircraft, typical of those used during the Berlin airlift. In this interview with Chapman University, he tells the story of encountering German children near the end of the runway where the planes of the Berlin airlift were landing.
And but how old were you at this time?
26. Gee, that was a long time ago.
Yes, you had the world by the tail.
Yeah.
All right, so keep on going.
Well, so before I went in the Jeep around town, I wanted to get a picture of the approach. Because in Berlin, before we put in the new runways, we had to come over bombed out buildings, very steep. And it was a bad approach. And then we'd have to flare out with a big load right quick. And I wanted to get movies coming over the bombed out buildings. So if I ever got married, I could show the kids. So I ran around the inside of the barbed wire 2 miles, shooting airplanes over my head, coming over on top of me, barbed wire fence, and all of a sudden, right against the barbed wire fence were 30 kids, 8 to 14 years old, right up the bar. Looking, the uniform was killing them a couple of years ago. And
oh,
they were friendly.
God.
They were friendly.
They were all very friendly.
Because Hitler's past and Stalin's future was their nightmare. And American-style freedom was their dream.
The children knew that?
Absolutely.
They did.
You see, their aunts and uncles in East Berlin and East Germany just walk across the border and come to the library to find out what's going on in the world. And they said, you don't want anything to do with those guys. You can't vote. You can't decide what you're going to be. They give you a 5-year plan. You can't travel. Wow, it's Hitler all over again. He'd just taken Hungary and Czechoslovakia. He wanted to take West Berlin and then get West Germany.
Right.
That was the situation. So these kids were friendly. Well, I talked to them for an hour in their school English, and they said, look, weather's good right now, but you wait until winter comes, and it's snow and ice, and you can't get in. It's hard to land here. When that happens, don't worry about us. We don't have to have enough to eat. Just give us a little, and don't give up on us. Someday, we'll have enough to eat. But if we lose our freedom, we'll never get it back. Kids, 8 to 14, I was dumbfounded.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, lost track of time. I got to run, get the Jeep. And I started to leave. And a little voice says, bah, they're so different. How come? And I knew instantly, because during World War II and after, I flew in foreign countries in the uniform, walked down the street in those countries where they had some chocolate. And the kids would chase you in groups like that. Grab you by the arm. I want some chocolate. And these kids had no chocolate for years available, generally.
Yes.
And not one of 30 kids had put out their hands and said, give me something.
Oh.
And when I realized how grateful they were for flour to be free, it just stopped me in my tracks. The difference between kids anywhere else and kids that had the need but wouldn't ask, that was the trigger. I'm only here because of the gratitude of those kids for flour to be free. And so I looked in my pocket. All I had was 2 sticks of gum. I said, holy cow, 2 sticks, 30 kids, you'll have a fight, bloody noses.
Yes.
But then I started to leave, and the little voice says, you'll never see them again. I couldn't get back the fence for weeks. I'd never see those kids again. You've got to give them what you got. And that small decision put my footsteps on where it leads to where I am right now. Went back, broke them in half, 4 pieces through the barbed wire. Kids that got the half a stick grabbed them like they just got $100. And here come the other kids. And the other kids just wanted a piece of the wrapper. And the kids with a half a stick of gum tore off the outer wrapper and the tinfoil and passed it around. And the kids with a piece of paper put it up their nose and smelled the aroma and smelled it. Their eyes got big. And I said, wow, I got to do something about it. So I just told them, come back the next day, stand between the bombed out buildings, barbed wire fence, come over your head about 100 feet. I'm going to check enough chocolate out for all of you. If you'll do what? Share it. Jawohl, they said. That means yes. That's the extent of my journey.
Of course.
That's how it started.
Halverson told the kids his plan. He would drop more candy and gum from his plane as he passed over the next time he flew. As a signal to the kids, Halverson promised to wiggle his wings as he approached their position. True to his word, on his next mission to Tempelhof Airport, on a final approach to the runway, Halverson did wiggle his wings and had the flight engineer pass three small bundles of sweets through the flare chute of the C-54 flight deck. The three small packages floated down on tiny homemade handkerchief parachutes, but Halvorsen could not see whether the kids had caught the packages due to the business of landing. Later, as he taxied the empty C-54 to the end of the runway to depart the airfield, he looked to the crowd of children at the fence. Three small white handkerchiefs waved back at him enthusiastically. Over the next several weeks, Halvorsen made many drops of candy and gum to an ever-growing crowd of appreciative German kids. Since he was unsure about how the Air Force would react, he avoided talking about what he was doing as he collected as much rationed candy and gum as he could from his buddies. He was called in by his commander anyway a few days later. "What have you been doing?" he was asked. To Halvorsen's surprise, his commander told him that a candy bar that had been dropped on the end of a runway had hit a German reporter in the head, and the story was now all over the front pages in Berlin. "The German people loved it, and that kept me from getting into trouble," he said. "My commander thanked me for the good idea and gave permission to continue the candy flying." The servicemen were by now contributing not only their candy rations, but also their handkerchiefs. They soon ran out of handkerchiefs, and the men donated shirt sleeves to be used as parachutes. Finally, they began attaching notes asking that the parachutes be returned to use again, and most of them were. Before long, letters of appreciation began to arrive for Uncle Wiggly Wings. Some of those letters requested candy drops at other locations in the city. News of the candy bomber spread in the media, and other people inside and outside of the military asked how they could help. Back in the United States, where the media had picked up the story, Halvorsen was asked what he needed to continue his run as a candy bomber. "Well, boxcars full of candy," he jokingly replied. When Halvorsen returned to Germany, 3,000 pounds of chocolate had arrived for him to deliver, and thousands of pounds more began to flow from the United States to keep the candy bombing effort alive. 6 months later, Operation Little Vittles, as the effort came to be called, made a special Christmas drop in an effort to reach as many kids as possible with candy, treats, small toys, and necessary supplies through the handmade parachutes. Uncle Wiggly Wings was not beloved by all, though. In an attempt to reach children in East Berlin, Halvorsen dropped candy bombs over objections from the occupying forces of the Soviet Union. He was berated by them for the attempted subversion of young minds. Not every kid could snag one of Halvorsen's little white parachutes with candy treats. Disappointed children wrote in to say they could not catch what came from the sky, were sent candy instead by Halvorsen in the mail. Colonel Halvorsen said that the children sometimes wrote him with special requests. "I received one letter with a beautiful map in it. The little girl said hers was the white house with the chickens in the backyard, and that she would be waiting there at 2 p.m. I never found her house, so I mailed her a package," he said. 20 years later, when Colonel Halvorsen returned to Tempelhof as commander of the airbase, the same girl, now grown up with a family of her own, wrote to him again. She invited him to dinner in the same home he had failed to find during the airlift. The two families, to this day, still keep in touch with each other. Another letter Colonel Halvorsen received was from a little boy named Peter Zimmerman, who had lost both his parents in the war. He asked the candy bomber if he could help find some people in America who would adopt him. Colonel Halvorsen helped to locate a family in Pennsylvania who welcomed Peter into their home. The story of Halvorsen's life as a candy bomber continues. Last Christmas, he was a guest of Tom Brokaw, who narrated the story of the candy bomber as the spirit of Christmas for the annual Christmas concert with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. A spry 92-year-old Halvorsen, still able to fit into the flight suit he wore back in 1948, stole the show with his comments about giving and service, to the delight of the crowd who got to hear his story and to meet him in person, a treasure in American military history and a growing legend in the history of Christmas.
God bless you. Through the years, I had many wonderful gifts besides these. But the things that these and other gifts pale in comparison to the fulfillment and the happiness of serving others, getting outside of oneself.
The latest news of Christmas music for MerryChristmasRadio.com is that legendary punk band Bad Religion is coming out with a Christmas album this year. That's news, folks, because if you know Bad Religion, you know not only that they're a great band, but also one prone to social commentary with no fear of political or religious backlash. That they would take on tunes such as O Come All Ye Faithful and What Child Is This is the ultimate in Christmas irony. What's it going to sound like? Well, here's a sample.
He's a farmer here in Wales, the books he only wills. Expressions on the faces of the starting millions. The power of the band, the fuel that drives the clan. He's the motive and the conscience of the murderer. He's a preacher on TV, the pulse of charity. The former that's written by the big computers and nuclear bombs. The kids with no bombs and a pitfall that he's inside me. American Jesus, see him on the interstate. We've got the American Jesus, exercising his authority. We've got the American Jesus, bolstering national faith. We've got the American Jesus, overwhelming millions every day.
Bad Religion, for us, brings us a good topic because it showcases alternative music that is out there and beloved just as Christmas music is in all genres. It was just a couple years ago that Thousand Foot Crutch brought us this revived classic, and it is the first of several alternative titles we'll share with you in this episode. So go ahead, turn it up.
Let's make this hot. I'm Mr. Sun, I'm Mr. Heat Blister, I'm Mr.
I never wanna see a day under 60 degrees. I'd rather have it 80 or 100 degrees.
He's Mr. Green Christmas, he's Mr. Sun, he's Mr. Heat Blister, he's Mr. 101. He's Mr. Green Christmas, he's Mr. Sun, bum ba bum. He's Mr. Heat Blister,
he's Mr. 100.
I never wanna see a day under 60 degrees. I'd rather have it 80 or 100 degrees. I never wanna see a day under 60 degrees. I'd rather have it 80 or 100 degrees. Then come Mazer, whatever I touch starts to melt in my clutch. I'm too much.
They call me Heat Mazer. Whatever I touch starts to melt in my clutch. I'm too much. They call me Heat Mazer. Whatever I touch starts to melt in my clutch. I'm too much.
He's Mr. Sun, he's Mr. Heat Blister, he's Mr. 101. He's Mr. Green Christmas, he's Mr. Sun, bum ba bum. He's Mr. Heat Blister,
he's Mr. 100.
I never wanna see a day under 60 degrees. I'd rather have it 80 or 100 degrees. I never wanna see a day under 60.
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
alternative music, and Christmas gives way now to some alternative history as it relates to Christmas and the Christmas tree as a symbol of freedom in America. Nobody quite thinks of it in those terms anymore, and that's too bad. If they understood this history, there would never be a controversy over calling a Christmas tree a holiday tree. In fact, once you learn this story, you may likely laugh the next time you hear the topic come up in the media, which it is sure to do. The story of the Christmas candy bomber underscores the importance of liberty and the part it has to play in the celebration of Christmas from World War II. For those kids served by Colonel Halverson, candy was merely the symbol of the freedom that they yearned for. The Christmas tree, believe it or not, was an element in another generation in the fight for freedom, leading up to the American Civil War. Here's that story. Slavery was debated during the creation of the Declaration of Independence, during the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and it raged between North and South for decades. In the early 1830s, an abolitionist group called the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, made up of African Americans and whites, men and women, saw Christmas as an opportunity to expose a hypocritical republic that proclaimed liberty for all, yet held millions of African men, women, and children captive in slavery. Largely driven by disenfranchised voters in the form of American women, they organized around Christmas a series of Christmas bazaars that sold gifts with anti-slavery themes. Of utmost concern to organizers were the unlawful rape of slave women and the brutal work conditions imposed on slave children. They attempted to bring to light these topics through their activities and Christmas bazaars. At first, these events were shunned by a civilized society that considered the topic too sensitive for public disclosure. That's largely because conditions for American slaves were brutal. Even slave children were whipped by white masters, a disciplinary practice that was quickly falling out of favor with the changing American public. The organization turned the Christmas holiday into a time for generous gift-giving that rewarded children. By emphasizing this kind of kind treatment for children, the women asked Americans to accept that enslaved people, who had even fewer rights than children, deserved Christian care and generosity too. Though the Christmas fairs were a primary source of fundraising for the cause, they also went far in moving forward the growing elements of the season in American society. Christmas cards were sold, Christmas carols were performed, and central to decorating for the event was a curious evergreen shrub, later to be known as the Christmas tree, decorated with festive colors and symbols of both Christmas and freedom. Bazaar sponsors replaced the small green shrub with a tall, full-grown evergreen tree, an idea inspired by Charles Fallon, a German immigrant who was a children's rights advocate and a professor of literature at Harvard University. He was fired in 1835 because of his anti-slavery activities. That Christmas, popular British author Harriet Martineau visited Fallon's home and became entranced by his towering evergreen. Martineau enthusiastically described Fallon's Christmas tree in one of her books, and the public became enthralled too. The Christmas tree stood as kind of a tall green freedom flag. Fallon's Christmas tree and Martineau's exposure of it in the media, coupled with the Christmas tree of Queen Victoria, captured the public's imagination and has since been a beloved icon of the season every Christmas. Think about that the next time someone calls the Christmas tree a religious symbol or a politically incorrect element of the season. It is as American as freedom itself. As we discussed in our last podcast, the war on Christmas 2013 is winding up, and this year we are seeing more international elements of it than ever. Ironically, in the city of Berlin, the same place where Colonel Halverson dropped his candy on the freedom-seeking children of Germany, there is a political push underway to limit Christmas because some feel the mention of it alone offends those who are not Christian. The famous German Christmas markets are now being called Winterfest, and last Christmas Berlin famously erected a tree that looked like everything except a Christmas tree. The secular celebration of Christmas is one we embrace because Christmas is for everyone. It is a season of peace and giving, and you don't have to adhere to the elements of one faith-based belief system to embrace peace and giving. Those are human attributes we're celebrating. However, the secular political activists who claim loyalty to inclusion do so more by excluding and discriminating against certain elements, specifically those who have religious beliefs. This is not affecting just Christians alone. Just as Winterfest is eliminating the identity of Christmas in Germany, so too are secular political activists rubbing out Ramadan celebrations during the summer months and renaming them Summerfest in Germany. What they are doing is an attack on religious freedom. Secularists will claim that the constitutions of democracies allow plenty for freedom of religion, but they will claim that holidays, references to God on money, and in the pledges of allegiance, and other public displays pointing to religiously aligned elements is, in fact, the state forcing religion on the people. This is why you see so much activity by secularists at Christmas time. To them, Christmas is about religion alone, and they just don't want to hear anything different. This is where many people get the war on Christmas wrong. It is not a war on Christmas. It is a war on religion. Christmas is just another battlefront in that broader war. To them, it isn't enough to just refrain from using the word Christmas. They want to ban Santa Claus, the Christmas tree, the wreath, Christmas light, and other popular elements of the season because they all, they claim, unfairly promote a religion on the people. Freedom of religion is the right to believe whatever you want. Religious freedom is the right to put those elements of religion in the public space. It goes hand in glove with freedom of speech. All have a right to promote what they believe, to suppress it through secular attempts to snuff out Christmas candles, to put away Christmas trees, and to take the red suit off of Santa Claus is morally wrong and an affront to freedom-loving people everywhere. Religious freedom is eroding and, in fact, under attack. The attacks on religious freedom are worldwide. DefendChristmas.com has showcased these issues in Germany, Great Britain, Australia, Canada, and, of course, in traditionally unchristian areas of the Middle East. The atrocities against Christians, specifically in war-torn areas of Syria and Egypt, are plain to see in the media and are clearly an affront to those who celebrate religious freedom. This is where much of the world is headed, and Christmas will be one of the first battles in that overall struggle. We soberly tell you now to pay attention to these things. We believe a greater escalation has begun, and the glorious celebration of Christmas we enjoy now may not be there in the future unless we wake up and recognize the difference between freedom of religion and religious freedom. You can put up your Christmas tree. You can say Merry Christmas. You can mention Christmas at school, and the songs of Christmas can all be performed in public. Do not let anyone tell you otherwise. Our look at alternative music continues. We've talked about the era of Christmas music from the 1940s, and here now is an alternative version of a big hit from that era. The song is Sleigh Ride, and this is August Burns Red. Hang on to your hat.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
In telling the story of Christmas at war, so often the focus is on the combatants. Those soldiers, airmen, marines, sailors, and medical personnel heroes who lay their lives on the line in duty. So often we miss the telling of what Christmas and war is like for those civilians targeted by falling bombs and marching troops. When World War II broke out in September 1939, it wasn't uncommon in Britain to hear the remark, "It'll all be over by Christmas," just as people had said World War I would be over by Christmas 1914. Unknown to people at that time, however, there would be five Christmases before May 1945, when this war was all over. By that time, the government's drive for maximum productivity had ensured that summer holidays were done away with, that Guy Fawkes' night had disappeared, the victim of blackout regulations, and that Easter eggs had disappeared. But at least a Christmas holiday still remained. It was 1940 when the harsh reality of war really disrupted life for most Brits. In September, the Blitz on London had started. In November, the devastating raid on Coventry had taken place. December targets of the Luftwaffe had also included Birmingham, Southampton, Bristol, Manchester, Sheffield, Portsmouth, Gosport, and Leicester. The nation had survived the Battle of Britain, and the expected German invasion of these islands had not materialized. But Britain was still under siege. There was a break in the bombing over the Christmas holiday, but everyone was aware that this was only a brief respite. And regardless, life and Christmas had changed altogether by this point. Documenting Christmas in 1941 was filmmaker Harry Watt, working for the Ministry of Information. His production, called Christmas Under Fire, showcases Christmas of 1940 in England, and the contrasts of peaceful Christmas observance against a brutal backdrop of bombs.
In England, as in the rest of the civilized world, Christmas has always been the day when the family comes home. Now sons and fathers are fighting in the air, on the sea, in countries far away. Others will have to remain at their posts in London or in other cities, driving ambulances, fighting fires, patrolling the streets. It will be a Christmas of contrasts. Holly and barbed wire. Guns and tinsel. Napoleon once said contemptuously that England was a nation of shopkeepers. Today, to be called a shopkeeper is a badge of honor. They've had their windows blasted out, their goods ruined, their stocks reduced, their customers killed. The toys which children have asked for this year aren't the toys they once wanted. They want model airplanes. For months they have watched airplanes fly over them daily, and children in England are proud because they can tell a Spitfire from a Messerschmitt or a Wellington from a Heinkel. They want tin hats, and they want to wear the same kind of uniforms as their brothers and their fathers and their sisters wear. For the first time in history, no bells ring in England to celebrate the birth of the Savior. No church bells are allowed to be rung in England. If they do, it will mean that the invader has come. We think of Christmas as a night of stars. We think of a brilliant moon giving light to a tired world. This year in England, people prayed for a dark and windswept night. On nights like these, the German bombers stay at home. A stormy night is an ally of England. And today, England stands unbeaten, unconquered, unafraid. On Christmas Eve, England does what England has done for 1,000 years. She worships the Prince of Peace.
Christmas Under Fire was nominated for an Academy Award and is now considered today to be the definitive historical record of Great Britain in World War II. It can be seen in its entirety on YouTube or purchased on DVD from Amazon.com and other retailers.
You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
Looking over the vast amounts of alternative music that is out there, we were struck at the irony of how many songs we consider Christmas carols that never really began that way. Consider the much-beloved song Carol of the Bells. Over the course of the 30 episodes of the Merry Podcast, we have played or used versions of this song by groups ranging from the Piano Guys to August Burns Red, who we heard a little earlier. Carol of the Bells is much like White Christmas in that a lot of artists perform it. But it wasn't always a Christmas song. It is based on a Ukrainian folk song of spring, of all things, that tells the tale of a swallow flying into a household to proclaim the plentiful new year that the family will have. The familiar four-note refrain from the Carol of the Bells was an arrangement of this old folk song made specifically for choirs, and in the early 20th century was performed by choral groups all over the West and all over Europe, where its catchy tune quickly gained in popularity. When an American choir director and arranger by the name of Peter Wilhowsky heard it, the song reminded him of bells, and he put the Christmas lyrics to it that you hear some artists still using today. It jumped from choral work to pop through live radio broadcast performances from folks like Fred Waring and his Pennsylvanians, the Roger Wagner Chorale, and others, and it has been popular ever since. We wonder what folks from way back when, 200 years or so ago, when this first came about, what they would think of this alternative version of the song brought to us by the Muppets. Here is Beaker, the Swedish Chef, and my favorite animal doing their version of Carol of the Bells. We have been aware now for a couple of years of Robbie the Elf, the King of Christmas Crunk. This is original stuff, and if you can't get merry from this, well, you just can't get merry.
Kick it! When Santa was a little boy, he didn't have himself the toy. He didn't have anything to play around, but he didn't let it get him down. He always stayed positive because he knew he was marrying Mrs. Claus. And there together they made magic appear. Then Santa got eight tiny reindeer on Donner, on Blitzen, on Wonder and Bo, picking off with Rudolph and his big red nose. Traveling all around the world, giving presents to little boys and girls. And when they finished sitting feeling good about themselves, they couldn't have done it without magic from hell. I couldn't understand why Santa picked up Frosty the Snowman on the coldest night we had ever been dealt. It was so cold I thought Frosty might melt. But really and truly Frosty is a nice guy. When Santa got stuck he helped him slide down the chimney and into the den. Saw me eating Santa's cookies and then
up the top, to the roof we go. We are almost slipped in the slippery snow. And when we finished sitting, feeling good about ourselves, we couldn't have did it without magic from L.
Go Santa, go Santa, go elves, go elves. Go Santa, go Santa, go elves, go elves. Go Santa, go Santa, go elves, go elves.
And when they finished sitting, feeling good about themselves, they couldn't have been without magic from elves.
Go Santa, go Santa, go elves, go elves. Go Santa, go Santa, go elves, go elves. Go Santa, go Santa, go elves, go elves.
Somebody bring me a cookie.
On Donner, on Blitzen, on Winter and Bo, leading off with Rudolph and his big red nose. Traveling all around the world, giving presents to little boys and girls. And when they finished sitting, feeling good about themselves, they couldn't have been it without magic from hell.
We close this episode of the Merry Podcast with a story I've been wanting to share for a long, long time. It is the tale of the Christmas Truce of 1914, and I have been struggling with how to best share what it really was. Most are familiar with this story of men in the trenches putting down their arms during the worst conflict the world had ever seen up to that point in history. But most media articles that retell the story each season and many websites that document the event have frankly condensed the story to just a couple of paragraphs, stripped it of a good deal of its meaning, and I find that a real injustice to not only those who live to experience the Christmas truce, but also to those of us left behind to really contemplate its lessons. Back in 2003, I heard a telling of the story unlike any other previously, and instead of trying to match its quality, I'm going to just share it with you here. Walter Cronkite tells the story as part of the annual Christmas concert with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. This is from 10 years ago now. This has been seen many times on PBS, and it's all over YouTube, but for every other version that is out there, this is simply the best and most complete that I have found. I'd like to give you some background on what you're about to hear, because it's basically a recording of a live performance in front of 21,000 plus people with the support of a large orchestra and, of course, a 300 plus voice choir. Cronkite is ideally suited to tell this story, and I've wondered how much influence he had over the script, because it bears his signature in many ways. He provides what I think is critical background about World War I and those who had to fight in it. The telling of the Christmas truce often skips the fact that those who fought on both sides were young, likely more connected than we realize, and were, as many wars before and since, confused at the war's purpose. Music plays a big part not only in the telling of the story, but in the history of what actually transpired. The telling shares a duet, one part sung in English, the other in German, of the classic, and I would note, German Christmas carol, Silent Night. Listen to it in the full context of the full story of the Christmas truce as Cronkite shares it in Silent Night. I guarantee you will take on a whole new meaning. I was lucky enough to attend this performance live at the time, and I cannot recall a more memorable Christmas moment. A lot of the credit for that goes to the arranger of the music, Mack Wilberg. Outside of musical circles, the name of Mack Wilberg is not widely known and certainly not well enough appreciated, but mark my words, someday Wilberg's name will be whispered alongside Irving Berlin and George Gershwin as amongst the greatest contemporary American composers and arrangers. This arrangement of Silent Night, flawlessly performed by the men of the choir, tugs at the heartstrings and moves you to tears. And I can tell you, as a witness of this performance, that night there were few of us who were not moved by what we witnessed, and what we learned in the music had a big part to play in that. For as great as this is, I do encourage you to look this up on YouTube, or better yet, get onto Amazon or eBay and buy this DVD. You can get it for about $10. It is well worth it to have it in your collection. Of course, there's a lot more to this DVD than just this story. It is that impressive. It is a visual experience as well as an audio experience, and something I think you'll want to keep. It is an important story in the history of Christmas. Here it is.
The story that you are about to hear is a true story.
The faces that you will see are the faces of the families of the choir and orchestra. The 1900s, the final century of the recent millennium, brought unprecedented possibilities and promise. The children of these 100 years would see more improvement in the human condition than ever before in the world's history. Advances in medicine, science, and industry would all but eradicate disease, extend human life, open a dialogue among the peoples of the earth, and lift them into the vast reaches of space. But these hardly seemed like possibilities as the Christmas of 1914 drew near. The nations of Europe were at war. Anxious to expand and defend their borders, they summoned their best and brightest to the battlefront. Young men answered by the millions. A 19-year-old German boy left his job in London to enlist in the German army. English boys working and studying in Hamburg and Paris returned to London, put on their uniforms, and went back to fire upon former friends. Secretary of War Lord Kitchener expanded the British Army overnight by allowing schoolmates to enlist together. The tragedy of these battalions was no more evident than at Somme, France. Hundreds of villages on both sides lost almost all of their young men in a single battle. The little paybook that every British soldier carried included a last will and testament, and thousands of these booklets were collected from the bodies of young boys, many reading simply, "I leave everything to my mother." With hardly a backward glance, the promise of youth was poured into the blind and futile aggression known as the Great War, World War I. The new century brought a new kind of warfare. Field commanders quickly realized that digging in was the only way to survive the sweep of machine gun fire. The German army had marched across Belgium before being stopped at Flanders Field. Some 60 yards away, British, French, and Belgian troops languished in trenches infested with rats and lice, pelted with freezing rain and shrapnel. As temperatures dropped, disease took hold. Snipers picked off those who raised their heads above those earthen walls. The war was but 4 months old, each side losing thousands a day, both to bullets and that silent common enemy, influenza. Between the opposing trenches was an area about the width of a football field, no man's land, littered with barbed wire and frozen corpses. It was a sobering reminder of what the future might bring. Soldiers who survived later recalled their brothers being gathered up and stacked like cords of wood. By war's end, more than 10 million would be lost. Not surprisingly, given the circumstances, most of the soldiers were religious and many were Christian. On Sundays, communion was passed in trenches on both sides, often to the sound of church bells ringing in nearby villages. The occasional hymn was sung, and youthful voices were heard across enemy lines. By December, the war slowed, and hopes for a quick resolution faded away. As the soldiers contemplated their desperate situation, nights grew long, and hearts yearned for peace. December 23rd, a group of German soldiers quietly moved to the ruins of a bombed-out monastery. There, they held their first Christmas service. Later on that night, a few Christmas trees, Tannenbaums as they were called, began to appear along the German fortifications, their tiny candles flickering in the night. Across the way, British soldiers took an interest in those lights as they sang together the carols of their youth. Word spread, and heads peeked cautiously over sandbags at the now thousands of Tannenbaums glowing like Christmas stars. Two British officers ventured over to the German line and, against orders, arranged a Christmas truce. But the negotiation was a mere formality by then. Up and down the trenches, men from both sides already had begun crossing the line to join in the celebration. Lieutenant Sir Edward Hulse assaulted the enemy with music. In a letter to his mother, he wrote, "We're going to give the enemy every conceivable song from carols to Tipperary." The Germans responded with a Christmas concert of their own. It was not long before the cold air rang with everything from "Good King Wenceslas" to "Auld Lang Syne." Days, those tidings continued to spring from the hearts of common men who shared the common bond of Christmas. Further down the line, a German violinist stood atop his parapet, framed against the skeletons of bare trees and shattered fortifications, and delicately perched in this desolate landscape. His cold fingers conveyed the poignant beauty of Handel's Largo. Whatever the spirit of Christmas had been before that hour, it was now, above all, the spirit of hope, of peace. A British war correspondent reported that later the soldiers heard a clear voice singing the beloved French carol, "O Holy Night." The singer, Victor Granier of the Paris Opera. The night watch must have lifted their eyes toward the heavens as they heard his plaintive call. Christmas Day dawned over the muddy fields, and both sides cautiously picked their way through the barbed wire. Side by side, they buried their dead. A German officer known only as Thomas gave Lieutenant Hulse a Christmas gift, a Victoria Cross and letter, which had belonged to an English captain. Lieutenant Hulse responded by giving the German officer his silk scarf. One German retrieved a photograph of himself in uniform and asked his former enemies to post it to his sister in Liverpool. Men who had shot at each other only days before gathered in a sacred service for their fallen brothers. Prayers were offered, and the 23rd Psalm was read.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, and my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Nineteen-year-old Arthur Pelham Byrne, who hoped to study for the ministry after the war, remembered, "The Germans formed up on one side, the English on the other, the officers standing in front, every head bared. Yes, I think it is a sight one will never see again." As the Christmas of 1914 drew to a close, soldiers who had sung together, played together, and prayed together returned to their trenches. They must have felt reluctant to let the common ground between them become no man's land again. But even as the darkness fell around them, a lone voice floated across the few yards of earth on which they had stood together. In the true spirit of Christmas, one voice and then another joined in. Soon the whole world seemed to be singing, and for a brief moment, the sound of peace was a carol every soul knew by heart.
Left, all is bright.
that's the way it was one Christmas almost 100 years ago. And that's the way it can be as we embrace the message of that silent, holy night.
Coming up in the next episode of the Merry Podcast will be a look at the history of video games, this being a historic Christmas in the ongoing advancement of video game technology. We think this is a good time to take a look back at Christmas's past with video gaming. We also will be looking at some of the classic advertising of Christmas and pass along more of the news of this season of Christmas. If you are an artist with music to share, or perhaps an expert with an idea for the Merry Podcast that you'd like to get out there, don't hesitate to email me at jeff@mymerrychristmas.com to discuss the possible inclusion of your Christmas with our audience here on the Merry Podcast. Thank you for joining us on this Merry episode, and we invite you to take in every past episode archived online for us at christmaspodcasts.com. We thank all the artists and contributors who have made this episode of the Merry Podcast possible, including John Schmidt, who provides our theme music for this and every episode, and John Williams and the Boston Pops, Colonel Gail Halverson, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Muppets, Bad Religion, Thousand Foot Crutch, August Burns Red, Darius Rucker, Robbie the Elf at robbietheelf.com, Paul Cardall, Maureen of the Merry Forums of My Merry Christmas, and Stephen Sharp Nelson. For all of us here at the Merry Network, Merry Christmas Radio, Kringle Radio, and MyMerryChristmas.com, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.